Hi, welcome to the channels, the Next Flow podcast. Today, for the first time ever, you're joining us in person. It's the Next Flow Summit 2023, October in Barcelona. And because we have so many fantastic people here in person for once, we thought we would take the opportunity to grab a camera, a couple of mics, and sit down with some of the people in the Next Flow community. Now, special guest today, Geraldine. Welcome. Thank you for coming and talking to me. Geraldine, it was your first day at Sakura yesterday.
That's right.
So, you know, no time like the present. Like, grab you before you run off. Sit you down in front of a camera. I thought we'd have a chat, introduce you both to the community, and also, I mean, it helps us get to know each other a little bit better. We're going to be working together. So, so you were the new lead developer advocate at Sakura Labs, a position that I have been holding the last kind of year and a half. I'm now moving over to product management for open source at Sakura, but still highly involved in community. So how does it feel to kind of jump in at the deep end at the Next Flow Summit?
It's daunting. It's very exciting. It's been a lot of fun so far. Very big shoes to fill, literally. I would say that so far I've just really enjoyed meeting people and chatting about what they're doing with Next Flow, finding out what kind of science they do, what motivates them. So awesome. It's really the sense of community that drew me to this, looking forward to.
We don't get more obvious exhibition of community than the Next Flow Summit and NF Core Hackathon. So, I mean, many people watching this and listening to this will be kind of familiar with your name, may have interacted with you in the past. You've been around in the bioinformatics community a long time. But I thought for the people who don't know you so well, or maybe don't know your background, it would be kind of interesting to chat about kind of who you are and where you came from and how you ended up here today.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, start us off at the beginning. Like, I mean, you started off in science. You started off in the lab, I believe, same as me?
Yes. Yeah, so I trained in microbiology, wet lab microbiology. I did a PhD in bacterial genetics in a lab that was focused on food and environmental microbiology. And specifically, we're looking at gene transfer, horizontal gene transfer, among different species in the Bacillus cereus family of bacteria. They're soil bacteria. They're everywhere. They're in our food. And they're particularly fun. And they became very relevant 20-some years ago, 2001, because it's this family of generally harmless bacteria that sometimes cause food poisoning. And then one of the members is Bacillus anthracis, which causes anthrax. They're chromosomally almost identical, but they have plasmids that have the genes that are mainly responsible for them killing you or not. So horizontal gene transfer becomes very, very relevant in that context. And so I did my work on that, and I could talk for couple of hours.
Still, if you have the time. Even though it's 20 years ago, it's burned in that into
still,
the memory.
I spent enough time on it. It's burned in my memory. But basically what happened was that I got some funding to do some sequencing. So I sequenced a large plasmid, which was a whopping 72 kb of sequence, which at the time took me a couple of years. Yeah. It was Sanger sequencing. It was primer jumping. It was very laborious, a lot of growing bacteria, extracting DNA, stuff like that, a lot of dishwashing. And so during that time, because I was getting a lot of sequence by the day standard, I got into Python. Well, original Perl, actually, BioPerl and then Python, because the way we did bioinformatics in the wet lab was you'd get the sequence from the sequencing provider, and they were very short sequences, right? 500 base pairs, bases. And you'd paste that into a Word document. and then keep that. That was your database sequence, was a Word document.
Amazing.
Not error prone at all. Then you
any date formatting in
in GenBank format, and then you'd paste that into the browser window at the NCBI Blast website, and save the HTML file of results.
Yeah.
And that was high tech.
Amazing.
But anyways, that was fine when you had like 2 to 3 sequences a month, but I was getting a lot more than that. And I was going a little crazy because I realized that I needed to change the blast parameters, as you do. And then I had to redo everything each time. And then I discovered BioPerl, and that was like, oh, suddenly I could automate stuff. I could submit the jobs to the server, primitive as it was at the time. And I honestly hated Perl syntax with a passion, but then I discovered Python and BioPython, and that changed my life. I taught myself Python, and by the end of my PhD, I was like, I really want to do more of that. Mm-hmm. Then I still went on for more wet lab focused postdoc.
So was that the first? Was that your first taste of programming? You kind of picked up a computer for the first time, like opened the.
I mean, I'd had a computer before.
Yeah. Okay.
But I grew up with Macs, and I was more into the graphical and artistic side of things. I'd never done any command line work, any scripting. I'd never had any formal programming training or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is part. I mean, very rudimentary SAS statistical stuff for like biostatistics course, which I failed. So don't tell anyone. awkward. I didn't know that some years later I would be teaching Bayesian statistics to biologists as part of the GHK job.
We won't tell anyone.
That was kind of how I got into it.
And how did you teach yourself? Was there anyone around you doing coding at the time, or you just picked
up? No, I was completely isolated. Everybody else in the lab was uninterested in that side of things, to be honest. And we did a like high tech stuff with you know genetic engineering and stuff like that. We'd clone genes and modify them and make our bacteria do all sorts of cool things, glow in the dark. But on the computing side, it was very, very rudimentary. And so it was all just open source online resources. The BioPython community was kind of starting to grow at the time, and people were just volunteers making, training resources and stuff like that. And so between that and just taking existing scripts and just figuring out by trial and error, by changing stuff and adapting the scripts to make them my own, finally got stuff to work.
That resonates with me and probably a lot of people listening
to this.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
And where was your PhD based? Because you're from Belgium originally. Was your PhD in Belgium?
Yes, at the Université Catholique de Louvain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent 5 years there. And then when I graduated from that, I actually did a few short stays in Idaho and then in Wuhan in China, which very different places. I learned a lot. I spent 4 months in China helping on a collaborative project that was funded by the European Union at the time. It was really cool. It was interesting exposure to, just different ways of doing things. Fascinating. But that was while I was waiting for my postdoc funding to kick in. I had a fellowship. It was a Belgian-American Educational Foundation that sponsored Americans to go to Belgium and then Belgium to go to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Boston for my postdoc. It was still pretty wet lab focused. But by the end of that, I was in the postdoc for three years, I think.
Was that at the Broad or was that?
That was at Harvard Medical School.
Okay.
In a microbiology lab that was focused. It was still like soil bacteria, but more focused on interspecies interactions, biofilm development, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fascinating stuff. But and I did. I actually my first interaction at the Broad dates from then. I got some got them interested in doing some bacterial sequencing. They were developing their bacterial sequencing technology at the time. And I had a lot of isolates with these large plasmids that made assembly more complicated because they had written a bacterial genome assembler, but they had, can I say this, forgotten to take into account plasmids. And so the plasmids were getting assembled into the genome. It was kind of a huge mess. Mm. And you have a lot of these mobile elements that are exist on copies on the chromosome and on the plasmids. And so the assembler is like, I can fit all of this together into one molecule.
Yeah.
I'm like, you shouldn't.
It's a difficult problem even today, I think.
It is. And so I had known plasmids with these conserved backbones, so I could tell, no, this sequence belongs to the plasmid. And so they sequenced like 100 isolates that were interesting for me from the point of view of studying the evolution of these plasmids. Mm. And so, yeah, that was my first interaction with the Broad, and it had nothing to do with me getting a job there afterwards.
Just coincidence.
Complete coincidence. It's more towards the end of that. I was running out of funding. My fellowship was expiring. My U.S. visa was expiring. Mm. And I had met someone who I ended up marrying. So, you know, I'm glad I stayed. As a result, at the time, I was looking for a job. I had planned originally to do the whole tenure track PI thing, have my own lab, but I was getting a bit disenchanted towards the end of the postdoc with the career opportunities in academia. It's a pyramid scheme. I'm not bitter. what basically happened was I had been working a little bit with a biotech company in Cambridge. And one of their execs knew Mark DePristo at the Broad, who was running the GHK team, which at the time was a small project that had been identified kind of as a really interesting software package coming out of the 1,000 Genomes project. And they had the problem that's very common in academic software, that it was promising, but nobody could use it if they weren't in the room with the developers. Mm-hmm. And so NIH was like, okay, we'll give you more funding to develop this, but you have to hire somebody to do full-time outreach and education to help more people use it.
It's very like forward-thinking to really prioritize that at that early stage.
It was an NHGRI project specifically that was called iSeq Tools. Mm. Seek as in seeker, but also sequence.
Seek error.
I've told my wife it's pronounced Sekira like Shakira. I don't know if that. it was very forward thinking. It was an experiment that NIH was doing, NHGRI specifically, was doing. To see how they could make, they were trying to invest in software, but making sure that it was going to be usable by more than just the original team. Mm. And I'm very glad they did, because I ended up getting that job as part of the GHK team. Mm. And the job was to write documentation and answer questions on the forum. Run workshops, training workshops. I've done training workshops kind of all over the place, which has been really interesting.
So what were the early days like when you first joined the team there? Kind of like, what did you walk into when you kind of started the role?
It was completely overwhelming because I mean, I'd done genomics, but bacterial genomics. Turns out humans, bacteria, we have DNA. That's about all we have in common. It was overwhelming because the scale of the data was completely different.
Can't do that in Microsoft Word.
Oh gosh, I've seen people try. Now it's Google Docs though. Human genome in a Google Doc. It was the scale of the data and also the complexity of the tools that were necessary, because GHK was, it involves some very sophisticated algorithms that at the time, like the hot thing was Bayesian statistics. Now it's all about ML, of course. But some of those tools were early forms of machine learning, basically. If you think about base quality score recalibration, to nerd out about that for a bit, it's fairly complicated. So there's complexity at three levels. There's the complexity of the biology itself, the human genomics is a complex field. There's, just because humans are complex, DNA is complex, you get my point.
There's biology is messy.
Yes, yes it is. Oh gosh. There's complexity at the level of the statistics, like the algorithms that are involved in processing the data and extracting insights from the data. And there's complexity at the level of computing, just implementing these tools and deploying them and using them in a computing environment. And of course, a lot of people having different computing environments that they're trying to use these tools in and use them at scale, at increasingly large scales. And so all these three levels of complexity kind of converge and smash into each other. And I had no formal training for any of them, really. Mm. And so it was very overwhelming. And I like to say it took me a few weeks to understand, to start to get to grips with what is even variant calling. Mm. Just even that I didn't know coming into the job. And my job was to explain to people what it is. Mm. So I had to learn it first. I just learned it on the job. And the team was very patient with me. It was a very small team. It was like 10, 12 people at the time. Mm. They were very small. They were embedded within a research group. And it was a really nice little group. They were very patient.
So what was the first thing you did? What was your first kind of project?
First project was actually set up a documentation website and set up a new forum because they had been using a kind of primitive one, but that was not working well for the community. So the first step was, set up documentation and user forum. Mm-hmm. And then every day, Eric Banks would very patiently sit with me and go through user questions. And
what a great way for you to learn.
Yeah. He'd be like, okay, what do you think of this one? And then I'd kind of mumble something that was completely wrong. and then he'd explain. And over time, I was able to start handling some of them myself. Mm. He also helped me start a little project of just testing with the test data, just running the tools and seeing what happens. And it was an interesting exercise because being completely new to it myself, I had all of the pain points. I was hitting all of the pain points that external users were hitting. And so that really helped drive the prioritization of the kinds of training resources I developed. And so for a number of years, it was really that. It's just write more documentation, training, tutorials, and also workshops. Start building out workshops. Mm. And I did one in my first year. I took two developers and we went to Thailand.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not a bad first place to do a workshop.
Yeah.
It was a two-day workshop and it was very rocky because we hadn't done it before. Mm. But, we learned a lot from it. And every time afterwards, we just iterated and improved it. Mm. That was the idea.
Yeah, sounds quite familiar with our experiences in our team. And I was thinking when you were talking about learning, I mean, Marcel, who's sat behind the camera, I mean, Marcel started on the role with relatively limited Nextflow experience. And his descriptions of learning on the job sound very similar, kind of answering user questions and then kind of going back up to ask all the people who are developing Nextflow and us old hands in the community and then kind of going back and you build up that your own knowledge base and very sympathetic to the end users as well, which is great.
And you end up sometimes being able to provide feedback to the development team of like some things just as simple as making the error messages more clear. Like you're giving me an error type number. That's not helpful. Mm. Can you tell me at least, but we're not really sure. Different things could be going on there. Well, tell me that. Tell me it has to do with my input file having a problem. Mm. Point me to somewhere where I can at least start to eliminate the possibilities. Just give me something to start from. Mm. Sometimes it was more on the usability, like try to be consistent in how the argument names are built, stuff like that. Mm. So it was interesting because it was also a bit of a learning experience of how software is developed and also how user experience works. Of like, how do you make it more accessible, the tools themselves more accessible, more usable for people.
So how did the, I mean, obviously what you did worked. I mean, TA2Go is probably one of the, I know, top five best known, most used bioinformatics tools, if not the top.
It's probably blessed. I'm sure there's a few others. Yeah. But in a particular niche, it's pretty unavoidable.
How did that growth look? I mean, how did it kind of track with you? I mean, obviously, the number of posts on the forum started to grow, and, you know, how did the project scale, and how did your experience of that scale with it?
It was really interesting because it grew fairly rapidly, and it was a combination, right? Because it was a combination of what we were doing for outreach and support was working, but it was also the tools themselves being used in some of the key foundational genomics projects kind of made it a little bit unavoidable as well.
It becomes the standard theme.
Yeah, it became the standard because it was the most used, and it was so it was a combination of things, and it was also very actively developed. The development team was very responsive to improving the tools and making them applied to wider use cases and so on. But that was always a little bit of tug of war in terms of development priorities. But the team was very proactive. But the scaling, I mean, it's true. In the beginning, we had probably a few hundred people who were, downloading the tools, and we were getting a few questions a day. Over the years, it scaled to being dozens and dozens of questions a day at some point. But you get to a point where you get the documentation in a good enough places that you start having fewer questions in the forum. Like if the number of questions you're getting scales with the number of users you're getting, you have a problem. The documentation's not good enough. But once you get enough in your knowledge base, And if your forum, the place where people ask questions, is searchable enough, people find the frequently asked questions and so on. So some of it kind of takes care of itself. But we did have to. We ended up getting some funding to hire another person, and then our scope increased to include the Broad's pipelining tools, Cromwell and Whittle. And eventually, once the Broad built its analysis platform, that came into scope as well. So up to about 2 years ago, I had a team of about 10 people who were doing documentation, frontline support, and the workshop type training and outreach. So that scales pretty intensely.
That's huge.
It's very cool.
And out of curiosity, I mean, you have a team dealing with kind of frontline support, like you say. When you have questions coming into the forum, what proportion of questions are being answered by the official GATK staff, and kind of to what degree does the community self-serve there and answer each other's questions?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because we were trying to have the official answers be the source of truth. I think we overcompensated for a little while. It's kind of a good thing and a bad thing because it got to the point that the forum was running very well, and in terms of we were getting answers, official answers, quickly to people. And so it became kind of the place to go ask questions. Which is a good thing in terms of if you want to control information to make sure that it's all accurate and that it complies with the best practices and all of that, which we were very conscious of, partly because we were starting to build industry partnerships where the concept of GATK best practices had value for forging partnerships. And so that became something that, we really nurtured. The downside was that normally we're in a typical open source community, you would have had more peer-to-peer support. We didn't get much peer-to-peer support growing on the forum, at least. Hopefully people were, at home helping each other. But But on our forum, there wasn't that much. I think partly because we had set the expectation that if you ask your question within a fairly short amount of time, you would get an official answer. Hmm. And so people didn't bother. We had some super users, and if you're in there, like, we appreciated it very much, especially once it came, you know, there are some base technical questions, but then there are some questions where it becomes more a scientific question of like, well, if I have this type of experimental design, then how does that apply? And you get into a gray area where it's more a question of the science than really how the tools work. So we did have some peer-to-peer support on that, but on the basics, it was kind of all us. Mm-hmm. And that's not great from a resource standpoint, from the point of view of the organization who's paying people salaries.
Mm-hmm. We can scale so far.
Yeah. And so over the years, there was actually a little bit of a reversing steam on that where due to funding constraints, we had to pull back a little bit on that. But I'm happy to say my successor in managing that did a really good job of kind of transitioning to a slightly different model. Mm. But those are that's kind of, you know, as organizations' requirements evolve, I kind of have to adapt. But
And a similar question for the training, like. You obviously ran a lot of workshops yourselves, and did you see much kind of grassroots training where people were running their own courses, and did you get much involved with that, or you kind of just...
That's interesting too. We did our official trainings, right? These like GHK boot camps. I think the kind of trainings we did, people were largely not doing it themselves, because that was really like 4-day trainings, very intensive. Mm. What we did see, I've seen over the years, many, many slide decks going around that were based on our training materials, but that reused them, like pruned down to what they wanted to focus on. And I think that's great. Yeah. And we always had the philosophy of, we'll put all the training materials online, and if you want to, you know, run it yourself, that's great. I think we could have done a better job of, you know, training the trainers to really equip people to do it with our lessons learned and so on. But generally speaking, we wanted people to be able to reuse the materials. We posted videos online as much as possible. All of the workshops we did were always invited by academic or nonprofits organizations, and we ask them, like, please open it as widely as possible. And if you're recording, please make the recording public on YouTube, just for reusability. Nice. I think we could have done a bit more in terms of, helping instructors reuse those materials. But again, it's work.
You have to choose which things you fight on.
What do you do? Exactly.
Can I ask you, just again, out of my personal curiosity, you don't have to answer this, I don't know if it's a difficult question. I mean, GHK went through this transition of licenses at a certain point. You were there during that time, I presume?
Yes.
Like, I mean, how did that look from the inside?
Oh, that was... I'm happy to talk about that. Wow, that was funny. Not funny, haha. I joined in 2012 in the spring. And the new licensing model was announced when GHK 2 version 2 officially came out, I think in September of that year. Mm-hmm. So I'd been on the job for about 6 months, and then that came out, and the reaction from the community. So basically it had been fully open source before, but and the version 1 point whatever was staying open source, but version 2 and up were meant to be a mixed licensing model that was free to use for academic and nonprofits, but paid license for any commercial use, with a little bit of ambiguity on what constitutes commercial use. Like, if you have a hospital has an in-house service that bills another part of the hospital for running it, apparently we were considering that.
Money was changing hands.
So. Yes, but it was within the same organization. And it kind of, well, anyway, I shouldn't go into that. But It went over so well with the community. People were thrilled. I mean, part of it was a way to make revenue to be able to fund the support, right? Because I like paying to pay my rent. So the board had to pay me to do it. It wasn't, I mean, there was some support from an HTRI, but that only gets you so far.
I've had this conversation before. Free open source software is not free.
Somebody's paying for
Someone's paying for it.
And you have to find a model to make that sustainable. So, you know, but it's true. It did complicate things in terms of, you know, small startups. It has a chilling effect because suddenly you're adding a tax on every run of GATK. It's complicated. The pricing structure can be complicated. Licensing is in practice. If anybody's thinking about licensing their software, it comes with so many complications. Somebody has to manage it. There has to be there's a contract involved. We're sometimes used to, you know, you go to the website, you put in your credit card, and you pay $10 for a single seat, and that seems very reasonable. But when you have the institute's legal people have to develop a contract each time with whoever's seeking a license, which is a way of doing things, you end up, it costs a lot of money.
It takes a long time.
Yeah, it takes a long time. So people had to wait to get their GATK license. There was a lot of rumors going around about the exact cost of the GATK license. I mean, long story short,
wasn't such a fun time.
No. It was not a fun time at all. It was absolutely awful because just from a personal standpoint, there were a lot of very upset people. And I was new to the whole social media thing. Like here, manage Twitter, which at the time was, you know, it was 10 years ago, is different. I mean, now it's dying, but that's a different problem. But it's very complicated, and managing all of that was a huge headache. And so fast forward, because it's open source now. It's
I was going to say, we can come full circle. Yes. We can look back with it.
We have. And we've even retrospectively reopened all the stuff that was licensed for a while, which for a while was not the case, because we had to do so much paperwork. And it took developer time to do that, too. Because you also have to prove that you're not opening up anything that belongs to somebody else, by the way.
You have to get everyone's consent.
Yeah, because they were external contributions. I mean, I learned a lot about software licensing that I could have lived without. But long story short, yes, it is now fully open source. GATK 4 was released in a fully open source way. And then the previous versions were retroactively reopened. And that was the culmination of several years of internal advocacy by the development team and various people who had a vision of, like, let's make all of the software we make should be open source and free to use, because those are not the same thing either, right? And so it was. I remember a particular meeting in Eric Lander's office where we pitched it, and we got the approval, and it was a great, it was a very great moment. And then we announced it, I think, at BioIT that year. I had the pleasure of announcing that, and yeah, it was
a good reaction. A negative reaction you had the first time, you had a positive reaction.
It was kind of the symmetrical reaction. It was a fairly small room where we announced it, but people got up and applauded, which was like, as a speaker, it's the best thing that can happen.
Absolutely.
And generally, for the community, I think it was a big relief because it makes everything so much easier for everyone.
Yeah, well, I was going to say thank you on personally, and also on behalf of everyone listening, I'm sure, for your work in making that happen.
Thank you. Many people were involved in making that happen.
So you kind of touched on this already, but I mean, let's move on. It's GATK scaled, that's great, but you started to take on other things. Tell us a bit about how things developed with Whittle and with Cromwell, and maybe a little bit of background for anyone listening about what those tools are.
Yeah, so I mean, it's every bioinformatics team, every serious bioinformatics team at some point has to write a pipelining system, right? I'm kidding, don't do it. I mean, there's a perfectly good one right here.
I've done one. I don't use it anymore.
There you go. So the Broad itself at the time was... one of the things the Broad does is sequence a lot of human genomes, among other things. And it became very clear very early on that GATK, you know, it's a bunch of different steps. You want to wrap that all up in a workflow so you can automate things, run things at scale. That's the classic pitch for workflows. Mm-hmm. So, of course, they wrote their own, specifically Khalid, who was amazing, went on a retreat for 2 months. We didn't see him. And then he came out of the wilderness with GHKQ at the time, which was an early Scala-based workflow manager system thing. It was cool because the workflows were deeply integrated with the tools. Mm. And so it was very easy, if you had a GATK tool, it was very easy to integrate it into a pipeline because the workflow manager itself understood GATK arguments and inputs and stuff like that.
You could tune it and configure it nicely.
So that was the advantage of having very tight integration. But then once you want to run things that involve tools from a lot of different places, that was more awkward. It was possible, but it was more awkward. Mm. At the same time, the genomics platform had built their own workflow manager for running, and that became... part of that became the Picard tools, and that was the site because they were handling the pre-processing of the data, the alignment and the cleanup and stuff like that. So the Picard team did that, and then the GATK team had their own workflows, and then stuff got stuck together and duct taped together, you know the story. In the meantime, the cancer group was developing their own thing, which was called Firehose. And all their tools and Mutect and all of that were running in Firehose. Fast forward to 2014-2015-ish, there was a kind of parallel movement to look at what's coming down the pipe. Literally. And the observation there was that, okay, the amount of genomes we're doing is just increasing. Daniel MacArthur is rolling up with projects like EXAC to sequence thousands of human genomes, tens of thousands. It's going to go to 100,000 eventually. The Broad's data center is going to explode. And so the question is, do we go to cloud or not for this? And so it's at that time that the decision was made. It was either invest in a new iteration of the data center or go to cloud. Mm. And this was at a time when nobody was doing cloud in genomics, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so partnerships were created. That was the time of the partnership with Google Cloud, who helped us kind of build out the cloud infrastructure. And so suddenly the genomics pipeline needed to go to the cloud. And going to the cloud is not just taking your existing pipeline and spinning up a VM and then running it
there. Unless
you
use Nextly. I can resist.
There are some things that are worth re-engineering, right? Because you have some fat steps and some narrow steps, and there's places where you can have a puny little VM. There's places where you need to have a lot more CPU or whatever. And so there was an effort to re-engineer the pipelines for the specifically the germline genomics side of things. And as part of that, like, none of our in-house workflow systems is going to be adequate. Let's write a new one. At the time, CWL was already starting to be a thing.
I was going to ask about that because, I mean, Whittle and CWL share a lot, at least on the face of it, share quite a lot in common.
Yeah. They evolved kind of in parallel. CWL was a little earlier, as far as I know, because I wasn't involved in that side of the discussion. But as far as I know, it was our engineering group didn't like it. They were like, no, this is not what we want. And so they wrote their own. And so that became the Cromwell workflow engine. and the WIDL language, which is stands for Workflow Description Language.
Sorry, and CWL is Common Workflow Language.
Yes, correct, yeah. Common Workflow Language, Workflow Description Language. They're both saying the same thing, of course.
I was on the other side of the fence. I remember being at some of the BOSC conferences and hackathons back in 2016, maybe 15, sometime around then. And I remember the hackathons of Michael Crusoe and others sort of talking about the very early days of CWL and getting together and writing specs and looking at vision. And then I remember hearing about WIDL shortly after and sort of thinking,
The key difference was CWL was written more for machines. Whereas WIDL, the intent was to make it as user-friendly as possible for people who didn't have much or any programming background. And so one of the developers specifically focused on coming up with a grammar that would be as user-friendly as possible and really separate very strongly the content from the workflow stuff. And it was, I mean, it's design decision, it's philosophy, but that's how we ended up with our own thing. And it was only used by the Broad for a few years. But then as it got used for a lot more external projects, there was kind of a recognition that we needed this to be more widely usable. And it was starting to be used by a few other organizations. And so we got together with some of those folks to say, let's make this a proper open source project. It was open source in the sense of the source was open in GitHub, but let's actually make it an open source project that has governance, that's not just Broad people and so on. And so that's how Open WIDL was born.
So WIDL became properly open source. So how did you set up the foundation and everything? What were the first steps?
Oh, we didn't set up anything, really, to be frank. Open WIDL is an informal group of enthusiasts who meet to talk about what the future of the language should be like. And there's a small core governance group that I was part of up till last week. I've resigned from that. But it's fairly informal. It's like a lot of these very small groups where we've talked about having a more formal, like, legal entity and so on. But it turns out there's a bit of overhead involved in doing that. So for now, I think it's small enough that the volunteer model of having folks who are of a good disposition get together and try to find consensus is working well enough.
We're talking a bit about the difference between CWL and WIDL. CWL has multiple different runners. There's Toil and Seven Bridges and Galaxy, I think, can all run with CWL. WIDL is primarily Cromwell. It was a naive question, but are there any other kind of runners that use WIDL, or is it about kind of pairing?
Yeah, there are actually. I'm blanking on it, and now I'm feeling very bad about that.
Put you on the spot.
But, what did they call it? The one. Mike.
We can edit this bit out.
There's a couple of other ways to run WIDL, but Cromwell is to date the only one that's like full scale. I'm blanking on it.
We can move on.
The other one, main one. I'm so sorry. I've rarely erased all of WIDL. No, I'm kidding. No. Cromwell is the one that's really geared for running at scale, running on different backends and so on. Has a system of pluggable backends that makes it possible to run pretty much anywhere, including on-prem, though it's mainly developed for cloud. Yeah. But it's also open source, but it's challenging to develop for because it's a very complex piece of software. Mm.
And how much has the WIDL spec changed over your time with it? Is it?
There have been a couple of major changes. We have the original draft that didn't really have any versions. I feel like every project starts in that state.
Yeah.
And then at some point it's like, we need to formalize. And so there's draft, and then there's version one. Gosh, we're still on version one. We've recently been talking about one of the 1 point somethings updates. This is where it's interesting, where you kind of run into a problem with there being too few runners that are like fully featured, because the Whittle community needs certain features to get in there to really make it popular. There's a few things that are missing that have been implemented in the language that are supported in the other runner. I feel so bad.
we can stop and you can Google it.
The minute we stop, I'm going to remember it. But they're missing in Cromwell, and because Cromwell is developed exclusively currently by the engineering team and the data sciences platform at the Broad, and they are under very kind of tight requirements. They're developing it as the workflow engine in Terra, and so they have development priorities that are very constrained, and they don't have. They want to. I know the development team would love to implement kind of some of the newer features in Whittle, but it's a competing priorities problem, and so it's been difficult to.
I think it's one of the kind of distinguishing features between different workflow languages. I mean, I get asked this a lot. I'm sure you get the same question. You know, which workflow manager should I use? Which one is best? There's no answer for that. I mean, you have CWL, which has one language, many runners. Whittle. Maybe fewer runners, but similar kind of concept of separation between language. And then right at the other end, you've got Nextflow, where the language and the syntax and the tool are so intertwined, you can't change one without changing the other. And SnakeMaker is kind of similar, though. Maybe SnakeMaker has more interoperability with CWL. I think it's quite an interesting, like they come with pros and cons. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pro of the Nextflow approach is, like I say, you can't add, a feature can never be unsupported by Nextflow because it is Nextflow.
Yeah.
But at the same time, maybe it's kind of comes with other, you know, other disadvantages. You can't have specialized runners necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting because I think there's probably some confusion about for Nextflow, about the difference between what is Nextflow, the workflow manager, versus the language. Mm. I'm still honestly a little confused and learning. Did I mention I started yesterday? I did run the Hello World successfully, so, you know, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I would say it's interesting how there's some key design differences that lead to, like you say, pros and cons. In the case of Whittle and Cromwell, I think the ideal there would be if there was like a community Cromwell, if there was enough of a Whittle community to kind of take over development of a community Cromwell to turn that into some what's the wider community wants, while the Broad focuses on its version that, you know, powers Terra. I think that would be ideal. I think the folks at the Broad would support that, but the complexity of Cromwell makes it a bit of a problem, and the community hasn't really grown enough to empower that.
I mean, there's similar challenges with Nextflow. I mean, the core, if you look at the insights for Nextflow, it's primarily developed by Paolo over the years, and the development team is growing, but it's still a relatively small number of people on the core team. And one of the recent approaches to trying to open up the core Nextflow tool to a community is to introduce the concept of plugins, which I'm going to mention that in my talk tomorrow, and kind of start to see this ecosystem of plugins for Nextflow grow, which is a nice kind of easier entrance point then.
Yeah. But the plugins is a nice idea, I got to say. I mean, the Cromwell's backend system is kind of like that, designed as with a plugin system so that you can... There are the main supported ones, but you can bring your own. So if you have a particular, you know, on-prem setup that's a bit different, you can customize the backend. You can do quite a lot on that front, which is good.
We've been talking too long,
yes.
And I've got so much more to ask you, but it will have to wait, I think. But just to wrap up, I mean, tell us a little bit about your experience of the Next Flow community so far, what it's been like. I mean, we've got the Next Flow Summit kicking off tomorrow. So we've got a lot in front of us, but tell us what it's been like the last couple of days kind of coming here and me throwing you in front of lots of new faces. And
It's been wonderful. I mean, everybody's been very welcoming. I will say it's a really great group of people. It's interesting starting at a company and meeting a ton of people, and I have to keep looking like, are they actually at the company or not? I'm gonna think that there's so many people who work at Sakara who don't actually, but some of the NF Core people are very active and so on, and so it's actually been really fun jumping in at the deep end. I mean, the whole point of this role is really to get to know the community and understand what they need and what they like and so on. So it's been kind of priceless, honestly. It's been 10 years, a bit more than 10 years since I've started a new job. So I forget what it was like the first time. Yeah. But no, this has been a very nice experience. And I look forward to the summit as well and learning what's next for Next Flow.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of all the talks laid out in front of you. It's a good kind of representation of the range of different things that people are using for use cases, compute environments, pipeline types. It's all there.
And it's really nice because sometimes when you start a new job, you have so much reading to do. You have to catch up on all the things. And it can be a bit of a solitary experience, just like read this documentation, that documentation. And here it's like, no, I just need to watch the talks and ask questions. And earlier there was a bit of a discussion at the front about config stuff, and it was going over my head a bit, and I must have been looking confused, and then Marcel came over and like started to explain the context and big picture and why it was a thing, and that was so helpful, so thank you. And just that kind of experience is unparalleled.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you for sitting with me today.
Thank
you for being here. Thank you for joining the team. Really excited to see all this experience of the other side of workflow managers you bring with you. I'm sure there's so much we can learn from one another. So I'm really excited to have you here. And let's see what the future brings.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you for listening, everyone.